Hello. We're making our march up the OSI stack at the moment, and last time we dealt with the physical layer, and mainly there's points for noting about the physical layer, and those include the fact that there are many different media, so everything from wires to fiber optics to radio signals, and combined with that sort of sitting on top of that, there are many ways to represent bits, and we said they basically broke into the categories of sending a pulse or sending a sinusoidal signal and then varying the sinusoid to represent bits. The bottom line from our point of view is that combining our media with our bit representations will give us, well, different achievable bit rates, and also significantly different error rates. Okay. From now on, what we're just going to assume is that there's always a chance of error. Depending on how you set up your system, that chance may be lower or higher, but there's always a chance of error. Because there's a chance of error, we need to try and decide how we can reliably send bits from device to device over this unreliable medium. Okay, so we, in order to achieve this, we have to, well, first of all, be able to detect the bit, the errors, and then have some way of correcting them. In general, this is done by examining finite chunks of data. Okay, so we instead of we can think of yeah, the physical layer is able to send a bit stream. Now that stream is going to be split up into what are called frames, and each frame will hold, again, a finite amount of data, and we can then examine that finite amount of data to see whether it's correct or not. So the issues we went over were framing, so how do we actually indicate where our chunks of data are beginning and ending? And then flow control, and we'll sort of see that the flow control mechanisms are paired up with our error control mechanisms. The basic idea behind flow control is that you don't want the sender to be sending at a higher rate than the receiver can process the data. Okay, and so you end up having some sort of signaling system where the receiver signals the sender regarding how much data they can take, and frequently that is typically done as a window-based system. So you allow a certain number of frames to be sent before the sender ha before the receiver has to explicitly communicate with the sender. And we saw that was done for reasons of efficiency, so that you weren't having to wait for the response from the receiver while you could be sending data. Okay, so that Windows-based mechanism also feeds into the error correction mechanisms. So you'd have two possibilities. You could do forward error correction, where you send enough data that the receiver is able to recon if, even if there's an error, the receiver is able to reconstruct. That tends to be hard. Or you can do backwards error correction, where if the data it arrives in error, then you resend that data. Okay, and so the major issues there are how do you detect errors? And so we looked at parity schemes and then cyclic redundancy checks, where the CRC, or cyclic redundancy check, is very effective and commonly used. And then we looked at re-request schemes, where the sender acknowledges correctly received packets and possibly negatively acknowledges packets received in error. And we saw that these could be placed, we could use our window-based control scheme to do this as well. So you could send a certain number of unacknowledged packets, and then you would have to wait. The sender would then have to wait for acknowledgments. Okay, and we had a look at throughput and efficiency for these schemes. So the idea is, you know, the window allows for greater throughput and efficiency. A window of greater than one frame allows for greater throughput and efficiency. We then mentioned HDLC as an example of a data link layer protocol. And it was defined in the 70s, but most subsequent data link layer protocols are based on HDLC and have similar mechanisms. So, that allows us, that's the issues of just getting frames from point A to point B correctly, but now we need to think about the reasons for our transmission. Okay, and we've talked about sort of forwarding packets from hop to hop to hop, and that data link layer fits fairly neatly within that. But frequently we have collections of devices that are sort of local to each other and connected to each other and wish to communicate with each other. So this forms a local area network. Okay. The key defining feature of a local area network is that we're not using the IP address. We want to handle all of our communication at the data link layer. Okay. So this poses an additional challenge for us in that local area networks use what's called a broadcast technology, which means that you have multiple nodes sharing the same channel. So if two nodes transmit at the same time, there's problems. We say that the transmissions collide and are destroyed, so the transmissions are not successful. That means we have to have some scheme to regulate how the nodes share the medium and try and avoid these collisions. Okay. And so we'll see this could take the form of turn-taking, or it could take the form of you allow the collisions to happen and then sort them out when they do. Okay, so again, I think we all have some idea of what local area networks are. Wi-Fi is sort of one example that's, you know, ubiquitous these days. But we'll look at sort of what our basic possibilities are, how can we set these networks up, and then we'll look at a little bit about how we solve the issues for these sorts of networks, or how we solve this resource sharing, and then look at some examples where different choices have been made. Okay. So our local area networks are just that. They provide a relatively inexpensive way to connect devices, and that's everything from, you know, computers to phones to printers, with each other within a fairly short range. Okay, so something where you can actually achieve essentially point-to-point communication. Now, this point-to-point might be either with an access point or directly between the devices. Okay, so the range is typically something on the order of a building, and they will be owned by a single entity. Okay, so because of that, they're also sometimes referred to as private data networks. Because of the short distances involved, we can achieve quite high data rates, up to gigabits per second. Okay. What we'll see is that we have a large number of setups for local area networks. So we'll look first at the sort of wired topologies and then move on to wireless, which sort of has evolved from the wired bus technology. Okay. So issues that arise again are the sharing of the medium and how we can achieve, again, reliable communication over a shared medium. The main topologies available to us are star, ring, and bus. Okay. So for star topologies, all of our devices will be connected to a single hub or access point. And there will be point-to-point links between each device and the hub. Okay. And so one example of this is the private digital exchange, which can provide internal telephony services, sort of again within an organization, so based on sort of a telephone type network. Okay, the ring topology also uses point-to-point connections, but now the connections connect neighboring devices and form a ring, so communication occurs by sending the data around the ring. And so the data will be forwarded from one device to the next till it gets to its destination. And finally, we arrive at what's one of the most common local area network topologies, and that's the bus topology. And here we have a single cable, and your devices tap into, make a physical connection called a tap into that cable. Okay. And you can extend the reach of the cable by connecting multiple cables together through a bridge, and we'll return to that idea later. Okay, so the final topology or non-topology we would have is the wireless technology, where, well, essentially everybody has a shared, direct but shared link to an access point. Okay. Now, frequently we want to extend the range of our local area networks beyond what is achievable on a single, over a single medium. So, again, it's taking the example of our bus. Our bus can only be a certain length, and after that, it doesn't work. And so, again, we can connect together a number of different local area, sort of single access points, and network those together and potentially out into the internet, and sort of more a different paradigm for data transport. So we'll first consider just single local area networks, so what you can achieve sort of within one network, and then we will look at, we'll say a few words about sort of making broader connections within, while still maintaining the flavor of a local area network. And typically what that means is, again, not using IP addressing, using the physical addressing of the devices as would occur with local area networks. Okay, so as we said, the biggest challenge for local area networks is that we now are sharing a medium. So if you take, again, the idea of our bus topology, where everybody's tapped in, if people transmit at the same time, those signals transmit over the whole bus and will collide and interfere with each other. Okay, so we're above and beyond what we spoke about last time in terms of just connecting devices and sending frames reliably. We're now going to have to deal with this idea of sharing the medium. Okay. And so we have three basic strategies for contention resolution. The first is that we can essentially eliminate contention, and we do that by dividing the channel up into independent subchannels. And so that means we, in this way, we can turn the channel into a set of point-to-point links. Now, this tends not to be overly efficient if you have more users than you have subchannels. At the opposite extreme, we can just essentially let users do what they want, so that they can send their data, and again, if there's a collision, then they can work to resolve that collision. And in this case, the nodes have to be able to detect the collisions, and when they detect it, they want to wait a random amount of time and start transmitting over again. Okay, so the hope is, again, that if you wait this, if the two, if, you know, if whoever collides waits a different amount of time, then you should be able to transmit. Okay. And as an improvement, we might want to listen before you transmit to make sure that, as far as you can tell, the medium is free, and also while you're transmitting, so that if a collision occurs, then you can at least cut your losses and stop transmitting. But the bottom line is that you have to do this. If there's a collision, your only choice is to resend your data. Okay, and then your other option is to impose some sort of turn-taking mechanism. So now the node has to essentially reserve the medium, and they will do that by obtaining a token. Okay, so they can only transmit when they are in possession of this token, and when they're finished transmitting, they have to release the token and send it on to their neighbor. Okay. And so the main variation is, the variations are on the topology of the original network. So you can use this sort of a scheme for, any topology pretty much, but there's sort of classic examples of buses and rings, and also then how the token is passed, who you pass it from. Okay. The bottom line with a reservation scheme is that it's usually implemented for fairness reasons, so it will work to ensure that all nodes get some chance to transmit. Again, certain nodes can be favored over other nodes by giving sort of greater chances to transmit, but everybody has to get some chance. Okay, so local area network protocols are defined via the 802 standards, and what the 802 standards do is they essentially define all of the various methods of organizing physically your network and then arranging your medium to share the medium over that physical network. And on top of this, dealing with all of the issues that we talked about previously about sort of arranging to get frames from point A to point B. Okay, so what this does then is it splits our data link layer into two components: the logical link control component, and that's concerned with addressing, link management, and transmission of data, so the stuff that we talked about last time, and that's standardized in the 802.2 protocol. Below this, in order to have this link, you have to have some access to the medium. So below this, we have the medium access control sublayer. And this specifies how we share the medium. And again, this is where we see that there's a huge number of different possibilities. And each of those possibilities essentially gets its own number. And its own sort of specification. Okay. So for each possibility, we have a physical layer, a physical, and how you share access to that physical layer. Okay. So 802.3 CSMACD, we'll have a look at, is a contention resolution scheme. 802.4 and 5, as specified or as named, are token-based systems. 802.4 is built on top of a bus. 802.5 implements a ring topology. Okay, and again, we have different media. And in the 802.11, 802.15, 802.16, we have wireless standards. Okay. So what we're going to do is have a look at a few of these protocols. So we'll discuss CSMA-CD as, you know, again, the contention resolution scheme. Then we'll look at its implementation or its related implementation, which is Ethernet, which is the dominant wired LAN scheme. And we'll see that it doesn't match up. It doesn't match up exactly to the 802.3 protocol, but it's associated with it. Okay, we'll then look at a token passing scheme. We'll look at token rings just again to see in sort of practically how they differ, and we'll discuss 802.11 as a as the dominant wireless LAN scheme. Okay, and again, this 802.11 evolved from the ideas of CSMA-CD, so we'll see how that works and what's different because you have the wireless medium versus a wired medium. Okay, so the LLC sits on top of the MAC layer and uses, again, the MAC layer, the services provided by the MAC layer, which are the access to the medium. Okay. And so the main, the entity produced by the data unit produced by the LLC is referred to as a protocol data unit, and again, this will be taken by the MAC layer for transport. Okay. So it will have addressing, and this addressing will be, these are logical addresses, which the physical address will be handled by the MAC layer then. It will have a control field so that it can perform the control functions that, again, we discussed last time for the data link layer. And what it doesn't have then is sort of the lower, is the sort of anything to do with the actual transport of the data. So it has no flag fields, no checksum, no physical machine addresses. The assumption is that the MAC layer is going to handle those, that sort of functionality. It's the MAC layer that's sort of actually sending it over the medium, so it does the flagging, it provides the error correction or error detection, and it decides exactly where the data is going. So the main function of the MAC layer, again, is to share the medium, or allow our different devices to share the medium. Okay, and we saw in the 802.3, we had a bus topology with what was called carrier sense multiple access with collision detection. And this is our scheme of allowing transmission, allowing contention, but then attempting to deal with collisions as they happen. So carrier sense multiple access refers to the idea that the transmitter, the sender, will listen to a channel and not send if the channel is busy. So this sounds quite sensible. And so the sender will only send if it hears the channel is idle. Now, the problem with this is that you can still have collisions even if you're listening, because other stations are listening as well. So several stations are listening, they hear the channel go idle, they send, and you get collisions. Okay. So we have to be willing, we have to have some mechanism for dealing with those collisions. Additionally, to improve our performance, we also use what's called collision detection. So here, even while the node is transmitting, it listens to the channel, and if it detects another transmission, so you're going to have a collision, then it stops transmitting. Okay. And so at least that way you're saving time. Okay. If you do hear a connection, a collision, then you have to enter a backoff phase. And so any node involved in the collision, or all nodes that hear the collision, compute a randomly sized time interval and wait that random amount of time before beginning to transmit again. So again, the hope is that if people are waiting different amounts of time, somebody will start first, the other nodes will hear them then and wait to transmit. Okay. So again, and for quite a while, this was the method used, and it worked well enough. From a theoretical standpoint, it's not terribly satisfactory, in the sense that it's possible that any given node will never be able to transmit. So there's no guarantee that you will ever be able to access the medium using this scheme. Okay. So if a node gets unlucky, it's never going to be the first one to get in with its packet, or the packets are always, or sorry, I should say frame, or the frames are always going to start, or keep colliding. So, just to take a little bit deeper look at this idea of carrier sensing with collision detection. As we said, carrier sensing does not completely eliminate collisions. And again, this is because it takes time for our signals to propagate along a channel. And so, if, as we see here in our example, node A transmits a packet, and that packet will take some time, tau, to reach node B. Then, and so B can send a packet at frame at any time before tau, and it won't have heard that A's packet. Okay, this leads to a worst case collision detection time that is 2 tau. And so that occurs when the first packet almost reaches the second node, and then just before it reaches the second node starts to transmit. Okay, so it's a time just before tau, the second node transmits, so we have a collision at roughly time tau, and so B will sense that pretty immediately, but A will not sense that until the transmission propagates from node B back to node A. So that takes a time 2 tau. Okay. Now, the issue here is that A needs to know that its frame was involved in the collision. And so, in order to ensure that, we have to have A still transmitting the frame when the collision is detected. Okay. So in CSMA CD systems, we end up having a minimum frame length where all of the frames have to take more than 2 tau to transmit. So they need to take more than twice, the transmission time has to be more than twice the propagation time. Okay. And if you don't have that much data to send, you pad out your data to ensure that that happens. Okay. So the analysis of performance for these sorts of protocols is somewhat complicated, and the complication comes from the back-off period. We'll later in the module, after we've done a bit of sort of our mathematics, we'll return to how we would properly analyze the performance of these sorts of algorithms. But the basic idea here is that our binary exponential backoff, so the randomization algorithm that we use, is, again, probabilistic. And if we make sort of some assumptions, and in particular regarding the use of the network, then we can show that the average cycle of contention is 2 tau by E seconds. So essentially E is the number of times on average you have to send the frame, and so that gives you a contention period of essentially 5.4 tau. Okay, so we will return to this. Possibly, we'll return to this later. For now, we're just going to again use that result and look at what it gets us. Okay, and so what we have then is frames are sent, and then we have a series of collisions. After which, again, somebody seizes the medium and a frame is sent again. So our average contention period, again, is 5.4 tau. So in terms of what's useful time, if you think of this as cycles where we are sending a frame, we're contending, then sending a frame, the useful time in any portion of that cycle is the time to transmit the frame, so transf. The total time of the cycle is transf plus w. Okay. And, of course, we can substitute 5.4 tau in for w. Now, tau is our propagation delay, so we can also substitute in prop for tau. And what we get then is our efficiency is a function of our propagation time relative to our transmission time. Okay, and throughput, of course, is efficiency divided by our transmission time, as we saw last time. Okay. And so what we can do fairly, what these results tell us is how our system is responding sort of relative to propagation and transmission times, okay? And so these propagation and transmission time relate to sort of physical properties of the system, so we can ask if we change those properties, what happens, okay? So what happens if the length of the channel increases? Well, the length of the channel increasing means that our time to get from one end of the channel to the other is increasing. And so if we increase that, if we increase our propagation time, well, we're increasing the size of our denominator for efficiency or throughput and throughput, and therefore we're decreasing efficiency and throughput. And that should make some intuitive sense, since if we increase our propagation time. We're increasing the amount of time it takes to detect problems within the system. Okay. So, what if we decrease channel bandwidth? Okay, and so what does that mean? That means that we're increasing the time it takes to transmit a frame. Okay, so we're decreasing the rate at which we can transmit, so we're increasing the time it takes. Okay. So, in this case, what we see is that our prop over trans decreases. That means the numerator, sorry, the denominator is decreasing. That means that our efficiency is increasing. And similarly, but if we look then at throughput, we see that the denominator is decreasing and, sorry, the denominator is increasing, and therefore our throughput is decreasing. So, again, that might seem surprising at first, but if we think about what we mean by efficiency and throughput, efficiency just is a measure of how often the channel is occupied doing useful work. So if it takes you longer to transmit something, the channel is occupied doing something useful more often, or for a greater proportion of the time. But if you send your packets at a slower rate, well, you're going to be sending less packets through the network, so the rate at which they're transiting through the network decreases. Okay. So, that's the basic idea of CSMA CD. And the original implementation of this protocol was Ethernet. Okay. And Ethernet still is dominant in terms of wired LAN technology. The difference now is that it doesn't actually implement CSMA CD. Okay. Or it's moved away from a bus technology. Okay, so it was the first widely used local area network topology, and it's simpler and cheaper than alternatives that have better performance guarantees. So again, if we use this sort of collision detection mechanism, then there's a certain inefficiency to that, but it was still easier to implement, so you just dealt with the inefficiency. It sort of performs okay, well enough to work. Okay. It has evolved over time and kept up with the ever-increasing data rates required. And so you can now get up to gigabits per second out of an Ethernet LAN. So initially, it essentially implemented CSMACD. So it used a bus topology, with collisions possible. So again, CSMACD to be used to deal with those collisions. Again, there's limits to the data rates that you can get out of that. In particular, remember that we need our transmission, our propagation is fixed by the length of the bus. Our transmission time, if we try and send things at a faster rate, we have to have sort of bigger and bigger packets. That's going to limit the length of the bus that you can use. Okay, so it's the higher, if you want higher data rates, there are some limits. Now, Ethernet uses a switch. Okay. And so what does a switch buy you? Well, you aren't colliding. So, what does an Ethernet packet look like? Well, we've got, as a data payload, we have our 802.2 PDU. And what the information that Ethernet adds to that is our error checking. The length of our payload, a preamble, allows the receiver to synchronize and receive the data. So, a start flag. And, of course, a source and destination address. So the source and destination addresses are now the physical addresses of the node as defined on the node's network interface card. All of these addresses are always unique. Interestingly, Ethernet does not provide Ethernet doesn't provide for acknowledgments or negative acknowledgments. Again, they can be in the control field of the 802.2. But it provides, therefore, an unreliable medium. Okay, so Ethernet is connectionless. There's no handshaking between sending and receiving network interface cards. So the assumption being all of the nodes in the system are always listening, so you don't need to set up the connection. It's unreliable. And so if you drop a frame, you have to deal with it at a higher layer. And it implements a CSMACD protocol with binary backoff. Although, again, if you're not using a bus topology, that's not really necessary. Okay. So, again, Ethernet has evolved over the years. And uses both bus and, well, bus and switching technologies. Okay. And the switching technologies allow us to have greater and greater speed within the network. So, what stays the same? Well, what stays the same for all of these is the frame that is used. Okay. So that gives us some idea of how contention-based local medium access is works and is implemented in practice. And as we said, the main criticism of a contention-based system is that if you're doing this back off, you're never guaranteed that any given node, well, if you're contending and doing back off, you're never guaranteed that any given node will have access to the medium. So overall the performance is okay, but you're not making any guarantees for any individual user. So, as an alternative to this contention-based way of doing things, token-based schemes, so medium reservation schemes, were proposed. And the main plus of these is that you have a guaranteed maximum time for any node to access the medium. Okay. So, under light loading conditions, you should get your turn frequently. And if you're, since you have no centralized controller, it's easy to add and delete nodes. The performance degrades sort of relative to the number of nodes, but if you have, what you'll see is in a collision detection system, if you overload it, if you add more and more nodes, then your system essentially falls over. But for this, well, it's the performance is relative to the number of nodes in a sort of linear fashion. Okay, and it's not the most popular LAN technology as we noted before. Okay, so we're wrapping up. I made a mistake here. We're wrapping up our contention-based systems. So, apologies. Some of the things that I said do apply to token-based, but we're actually looking at not token-based, we're looking at our contention-based systems. They work well under light loading conditions. And I actually would contend they don't have terribly graceful performance degradations relative to the number of nodes. Yeah, you actually, you do have a cap on the number of nodes that you can use this sort of a technology with. The only exception to that, of course, would be if you've gone to a switched system. Okay. It is a distributed protocol, so it's easy enough to add nodes. You aren't changing any of the existing ones. Okay, and it is the most popular LAN technology. Okay. So, it... We'll examine the performance degradation. We'll examine the performance later in more detail. So, for a bus topology, it does require more complex collision detection circuitry. You have to have a minimum frame length. Priorities are not explicitly supported. You could possibly support them through the back-off mechanism, but it would require a change to the existing protocol. Channel access time, as we said, is unpredictable, can be infinite. And as the load increases, that access time is theoretically unbounded. So, the question is, what can you do about this? Well, the main thing to do is to try to eliminate contention. And one way we can eliminate contention is by going to a switched system. But another way is to regulate the access to the medium via tokens. Okay. And so these sorts of systems were proposed in the 80s as an alternative to Ethernet that offered some guarantee on access to the medium. And so two of the main contenders were the 802.4 bus token bus standard or the 802.5 token ring standard. So in both of these cases, they implemented a turn-taking mechanism, so you pass the token around from node to node to node, and this ensured that the time to access the medium was bounded, so you had a guaranteed upper limit to how long it took to access the medium. Okay, so we'll look at the token ring system. I don't think I actually mentioned the token bus, but from a theoretical point of view, the main aspect is to use this token to ensure that there is no contention for the medium. Okay, so our ring is actually a set of point-to-point links which connect our nodes in a circular fashion. Okay, so the connections then define the path that the data has to travel. If the node wants to send data, then it must have access to a token, which is a special frame which passes from one node to the next. Okay. And the node can only transmit data frames when it has the token. Okay. So when the node gets access to the token, it removes it so that nobody else can see it, and then transmits its data. So in the simplest form, it'll transmit one frame and then put the token back on the ring. And so that the token is transmitted to the next node, so the one that the sending node was connected to. Removing the token essentially means changing a flag so that it's indicated that the token is not available. Okay. So the stations can determine the state of the network by examining single bits, and so there's with a 1-bit delay, they can forward the data around the network. Okay, so again, we see that the token is going to travel around the ring as is defined by the physical topology. If a station A has data to send, it seizes the token, so it flips the bit and sends the data on to D. The data, in the simplest form, the data, it transmits all the way around the ring with D copying it, since the data is intended for D, and then travels back to station A, and when A sees the data coming back to itself, sees the token coming back to itself, it releases that token. Okay. So, again, we have our PDU, our 802.2 PDU as before. And the data is then encapsulated within a frame. And we see that the frame has various fields. The portions of the frame that denote the token are the start flag, the access control, so that's the bit that's the priority, plus the end delimiter, and finally, and so that is used to indicate the token, and again can be incorporated into the frame. Okay. So additionally, we need our addressing. We have a frame type used for the maintenance of the ring, and we have a frame status, which indicates indicates that the receiver received the frame. Okay. So again, that allows us, that's the information that allows us to implement our token ring and implement token passing. Okay, so in terms of performance, how well does this sort of a system work? And we are going to make the assumption that we have heavy traffic, so we always have frames to transmit, and therefore a cycle consists of all of the nodes waiting for the token, getting a turn to transmit their frame, and then releasing the token. Okay, so essentially, if everybody wants to transmit, you just have a turn-taking, you've implemented a turn-taking mechanism by which each person can transmit. So, for each person, what do we have? We have to transmit the frame. For each node, we transmit the frame. We transmit the token. We transmit the frame. The frame propagates around the rings. We have a propagation time. And when it's finished propagating, we transmit the free token. Okay. Additionally, that token propagates from station to station to station, and so by the time everybody's taken their turn, the token will have traveled all the way around the ring, adding one final propagation time here. Okay. And so what we see then is the cycle is the amount of time that takes is dependent on how many nodes you have who want to get a turn. Okay. So, the useful time within a cycle is obviously the time it takes to, that's being taken to transmit data. And so, the efficiency is the useful time over the cycle time. You can look at that yourself. And again, we may say that the transmission time is negligible, and if we have a lot of stations, then this additional propagation time for the token to transmit is also dwarfed by the propagation of the packets. So you have n prop, the time it's taking the frames to be transmitted around. So if n is large, then adding one more is not significant. So you end up with your cycle time is roughly n times trans f plus prop. And if you plug that in, you'll get that your efficiency is roughly 1 over 1 plus a, where a is prop over trans. Okay. And so, again, as you would expect, the larger trans is relative to prop, the more efficiency you have. And this can go up to, if your transmission time is large, really large, relative to your propagation time, then you're pushing up towards 100% efficiency. Okay, and again, throughput will be efficiency divided by trans F. And so the same thing will apply, that throughput then is a balance between a sort of a fast transmission time and relative to your propagation. Okay. So, again, that's looks a lot nicer than, what we had before. The main drawback is that, again, it's more expensive to implement and manage. Okay. One thing that we can calculate for token-based schemes that we can't calculate for contention-based schemes is what's the worst case access time for a frame, or really the worst case access for a node to gain access to the medium. And so this is referred to as the MMAT, the minimum maximum access time, and, you know, as you would expect, it's just the cycle time. Okay. Now, to, as we said, the longer you transmit for, the more efficient the system becomes. So one possible modification is to allow multiple frames to be transmitted whenever a token is accessed. And so now we have, instead of transmitting a single frame, we can transmit as much data as we have during what's called a token holding time. And so that allows us to transmit more data within a given cycle. And again, our efficiency is, we just need to substitute token holding time in for transf. Assuming that we always have data to send, and as we noted before, the larger transf, so the bigger the token holding time, the more efficient our system becomes. And we can do that without affecting our throughput. And obviously the access time is now a matter of the token holding time. Okay, so there are still places and where token rings and token buses are used. FDDI is a token bus, essentially a token bus scheme, and is used in some backbones. Ring topologies are used in fiber optic metropolitan area networks. So they are used in some places, but in terms of local area networks, pretty much it's either Ethernet or, as everybody would be familiar, Wi-Fi. Okay. So the other big implementation of local area networks these days is wireless local area networks, or Wi-Fi, as defined by the 802.11 standard. And again, this standard has a number of different implementations which have to deal with the bandwidth, or sorry, the band at which the signal is broadcast, and the modulation techniques So we won't worry about what DSS means or OFDM, but different versions of the 802.11 standard use different modulation techniques. Okay. All of the different versions are denoted by separate letters, and the letters reflect when the standard was first proposed, as opposed to sort of when or if it was implemented. Okay. So, we're not going to deal with any of the complexities of the transmission or or medium access beyond to look at how it we'll deal with medium access in the term in the context of it's again a collision based system. Okay. So, in wired Ethernet, we can assume that when a frame is transmitted, it's correctly received modulo collision. So if it doesn't, if it's transmitted and doesn't collide, then we pretty much assume that it's okay. Radio environments are not that forgiving. And so in the original versions of 802.11, we always used acknowledgement for when frames were received. So we did not transmit a second frame until we had received our first. 802.11n onwards allows for more of a go back n. It's sort of a larger than one window. So typically, you know, the setup that we would think of is you would have a bunch of nodes, so phones, laptops, etc., connecting to an access point. And so the sending can either happen using a distributed coordination function, so in a contention-based fashion, or potentially you could use your access point to implement turn-taking, so a polling system where the access point acted as a centralized controller and regulated your access. So the second PCF is not commonly implemented, and hence a mix of PCF and DCF is also, or a hybrid control function is also not commonly implemented. Okay, these PCF and HCF would, you know, you could imagine be good for quality of service and guaranteeing access to the medium, but usually aren't used. Okay, so we're going to assume that our system is using DCF and contending for the medium, and we'll use a contention-based access then, like CSMA-CD. The problem is that, unlike on a bus, if you have wireless signals, not all of the nodes hear the same things. So a node may not be able to detect a collision, but we still use collision avoidance, where we try to have a mechanism by which we won't have multiple nodes. Sending at the same time, if we can avoid it. Okay, so we're going to look again at how this works at, you know, simply, and we'll defer the analysis of the performance of this till later on in the module. Again, it's, as you can imagine, it's the analysis is complicated, and it's dependent on the back-off mechanism and the random nature of the node transmissions. Okay, so it's quite similar to CSMA/CD. We want to listen to the channel. If we don't hear anything, we start transmitting. If we do hear something, we back off. And if a collision occurs, we back off some random time again and start the cycle over again. Okay. Again, the problem with this system is the fact that not all of the nodes are hearing the same things. Okay, and this can make it hard to determine when a collision, this can be hard to, this makes the listening aspect harder. Okay. So we have our, in a wireless network, our received signal is a combination of the transmitted signal, interference from other transmissions, and noise. And we can only hear the signal if it's received at a sufficient power level. And the power drops exponentially with distance. Okay, so there's only a certain range within which the nodes can hear each other. So here, and so you usually assume that the nodes are transmitting at roughly the same power level, and that gives them a certain radius of transmission within which nodes will hear their signal. So if we think of NTX as being our transmitter, then NH, our hidden node, doesn't hear it, hear any transmission from it. NE does hear a transmission from it. So if you're within the circle, you'll hear. If you're outside the circle, you won't hear. Okay. So this leads to two issues that don't occur for the for the wired medium. We have a hidden node problem and we have an exposed node problem. Okay, and the idea of the hidden node problem is that there are nodes which are going to be outside of the range of the transmitter, but the receiver will be within their range. Okay, so if NTX, our transmitter node, wants to transmit to NRX, then NH won't hear it. So our hidden node does not hear it. And that means that our hidden node will feel free to broadcast or to send its own signal. That signal will be within the range of our receiver, so we'll interfere with our original transmission. Okay, and so we can assume that we're going to lose our transmission. Okay, and that happens because we cannot fully sense the medium. So another interesting phenomena that arises is what's called the exposed node. They call it a problem, but it's just an issue. And so if, again, we take our transmitting node sending to our receiving node, then our exposed node is within the range of the transmitter. However, it should be, if our exposed node were to transmit, our receiver is actually outside of the range of our exposed node. So possibly we could allow our exposed node to transmit as well. It would not interfere with the reception from our original transmission. Okay. This is referred to as the exposed node problem, and the issue again is that we could possibly have multiple transmissions going on within our wireless network at the same time, as long as they didn't disappear, that didn't interfere with each other. So the question is, how do we know whether they're going to interfere with each other? So, the power level at which you transmit is going to affect the size of these ranges. And so the lower the range, if we think of that in terms of a threshold, the lower the threshold, the fewer hidden nodes you're going to get, but the more exposed nodes. So the lower the threshold, the greater the range. And so the more people can hear, so that means more exposed nodes. The higher the threshold, the smaller the range. So you get fewer exposed nodes, but more hidden nodes. The question becomes, what can we do about that? And the answer is that we can improve, we can have a signaling protocol that allows all of the nodes to have a clearer view of what's going on in the network. So we add two messages called request to send and clear to send. Okay, and so a transmitter will send the request to send message. The receiver will send a clear to send message. Okay. So how do the other nodes react to that? A hidden node will not receive the request to send message, but it will receive the clear to send message, and therefore it won't transmit. An exposed node will hear the request to send, but it won't hear the clear to send. And again, it will know that it's not within the range of the receiver and it's free to transmit. Okay. As you can see, this adds overhead to the system, and for that reason is frequently not used. You just, it, it, deal with the collisions as they come. Okay. So, also in the interest of sort of improved performance, the 802.11 frame has what's called can carry what's called a network allocation vector, and so that indicates the amount of time the channel is going to be busy. So listening nodes know for how long they have to wait. Okay. We can play around with these wait times and listening times in order to introduce a form of priority. So the wait time is indicated with an interframe spacing, and the shorter your interframe spacing, the more likely you are to transmit. So if you're waiting a short time, somebody else is waiting a longer time, you're going to get in there first. So, not surprisingly, control packets like RTS-CTS and acknowledgments have high priority. Data has lower priorities. And other sort of network management, lower priorities again. Okay, so just to see how that works, you have a frame to transmit, you listen, and if you don't hear anything, you wait for your interframe spacing. So again, that can have a different amount of time. You listen again, and if you still don't hear anything, you transmit your frame. Okay, if you do hear something, you wait until the current transmission ends. You'll know that through the nav. You wait in interframe spacing, so that gives the priority. If you're idle, if you're not idle, you start again. If you are idle, you still randomize the amount of time. And you sort of assume that there's multiple people waiting to transmit, and you still randomize the amount of time before you transmit. Then you transmit your frame. Okay. Again, the contention window is gives us your backoff period, so you choose randomly between backoffs. The more times you sense, the more times you have collisions, the more you increase the size of the contention window. And once you've frequently sent a packet, you reset the contention window to the minimum value. I'm not going to say much about the framing, except to note that, again, to deal with the wireless nature, you have a lot more fields within the frame. So you have your PDU. You have four sets of addresses, which have to do with possibly having access points and control and controllers, as well as the actual place you want to send your data. And frame control deals with a lot of issues having to do with wireless networks, so it allows you to indicate your request to send clear to send. It allows you to do power management. It allows you to encrypt, etc. So again, just because of the additional complexity of the networks, you have bigger, more complex frames. Okay, so that's it for local area networks. Again, the main takeaway point is that here we're sharing a medium, and so we need to have some method of sharing that medium. The two main possibilities are either a turn-taking mechanism or a contention-based mechanism. The analysis of performance for the contention-based mechanism is a little more complex to deal with, and you need to have some sort of probability and queuing results to do it. So we'll take that up again later in term. So we'll take a break now, and when we return, we'll just have a short discussion of connectivity and devices used to forward packets over multiple hops, and we'll sort of categorize them according to what layer of the network they reside at. So we'll that should be a relatively short discussion later.